From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Getty. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
There are good reasons for believing that policy is going to move in a more libertarian direction than you might think.
For years, we've counted on the Public Religion Research Institute to bring a clear-eyed perspective to the major issues and trends of our day, meticulously compiling data on who our fellow Americans are and what they believe, and then presenting that information in a coherent and eminently useful way. A highlight is the Institute's annual American Values Survey, and the 2013 edition has just been released. With a particular focus this time around on libertarians, the survey offers plenty of useful insights as to the direction our nation is likely to be moving and why. And on this week's show, the head of the Institute, CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones, will be right here in the studio with us to introduce us to some of the highlights and give us insights behind them.
Surely you must be persuaded by all the religious traditions, all of them, which say God calls us to care for this planet.
As evidence continues to mount that humanity plays a significant role in global climate change and will, in many parts of the world, suffer from that change, a great deal of resistance to acknowledging any of this continues to exist, primarily among the unholy alliance of conservative Christian and pro-business interests that conspired so tirelessly to oppose health care reform and other social justice causes. Leading the charge to redefine environmentalism and concern over climate change as issues evangelical Christians should be taking the lead on is the Reverend Richard Cizik, president of the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, and he'll be with us later on in this week's State of Belief Radio, and you're going to be amazed at the emphasis he makes and the passion with which he makes it. And I have something I really want you to do, and I'll tell you about it a little bit later in the show. But first,
some had waited decades, and at the stroke of midnight, the moment arrived as New Jersey became the 14th state to legalize same-sex marriage.
Last month, after years of foot-dragging, New Jersey rather abruptly became the latest state to permit marriage equality. Yay! With bipartisan support in the legislature, the issue had been held up by a veto threat from Governor Chris Christie until a federal judge handed him a way out, meaning a way for the potential Republican presidential contender to still be against marriage equality, as today's misguided conservative litmus test requires, while satisfying his state's strong support for ending discrimination. In looking at this change and the grand sweep of progress on LGBT rights in general, I have no problem impugning the motives of political and faith leaders who play on the fears and prejudices of their followers to perpetuate bias and discrimination in the name of morality or religion. But because that technique continues to work among a significant percentage of our population, it's particularly important for reassuring voices of inclusion and acceptance to counter it, just as Governor Christie was announcing that he would not challenge the pro-marriage court ruling. My first guest was tying the knot with her longtime partner, with the mayor of Jersey City officiating as a cantor at a leading New Jersey synagogue and a gay woman. Meredith Greenberg is one of the growing number of non-revolutionaries who help create the space for people of faith to defy the divisive messages we hear every single day. And I'm very pleased to welcome the newlywed to the show. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
First of all, congratulations to you and Leora.
Thank you.
After almost 20 years together, what was it like to stand there and say the vows together?
We were sort of laughing before the ceremony began because we have been making promises and vows to each other for a lot of years and keeping them, actually, and teaching our three children about the strength behind one's words and saying things that you mean and having people witness you and hearing you say them and affirming you.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't sure if it was going to feel like, you know, a real moment and a really different significant change. But I have to say, I was humbled by how emotional and how significant it really was for us. We've been together for, as you mentioned, a really long time. And when we first got together, in truth, I didn't allow myself to even believe that something like marriage and perhaps even a family was an option for me. It wasn't an available option, certainly when I looked around. Marriage was not sanctioned by our government. And yet, as I'm blessed to say, love emboldens you. It, it makes you courageous. It fills you with thoughts of inspiration and sustains you to go out into the rest of the world and stand up for what you believe and ask for what you know in your heart you deserve.
I love what you're saying and the joy with which you're saying it and identify with it. But there is a side of me. I was out in Iowa about 3 or 4 weeks ago to do a wedding ceremony for two dear friends who've been together almost 30 years. And I have to say, and maybe it's just a flaw in my character, but I was a little hacked off that we had to wait that long and that we had to go through what we've gone through for people who are more married than most people in the United States are married to be recognized for it.
Right. You know, on Sunday, we got this phone call from the really terrific organization, New Jersey United for Marriage, because I had been doing advocacy work with them and with other organizations for, you know, the last many years here in New Jersey. And I was asked, you know, if we would be one of the couples that got married. And as I often do every week at the very end of our Sabbath of Shabbat, I open up my Tanakh, my Hebrew Bible. I look at what the Torah portion is for the coming week. So I start to study. And I was so excited and delighted because actually the first marriage in our text happened last week in the Torah. And it's such a funny thing where in ancient days, there was no government sanctioning for marriage. You know, a couple looked in one another's eyes and understood that God brought them together. And they went into a tent and they were married.
Yeah.
And the truth is that I have many, many, many friends and relatives who have been in long time, very authentic, rich, meaningful, significant relationships. And it's silly to now all of a sudden call ourselves married when, of course, we have been married for a long time.
Sure.
But language is so powerful.
It is.
And because our state affirms us, our friends and neighbors know what to call us. And know how to use language to affirm us. And that's a powerful thing for everyone. We all won because we can have this change in the way that we speak about these relationships. So I wish it had taken less time. But in my time with my now wife, we've gone from not even praying for marriage to happen to now seeing it happen in not as much as many states as we'd like, but it's the beginning.
Yeah. How do your personal experiences inform your experiences in ministry?
I have to tell you that I don't know if I could be doing the really demanding, extremely challenging work that I think is God's work daily, every day, out in my community with my congregation, but in with a larger community as well, unless I had the sustaining, inspiring life that I have at home. In fact, I wasn't really outspoken about marriage equality until after my wife and I stood under the chuppah and had a very traditional, very beautiful Jewish wedding 12 years ago. It was from that experience that I understood how important it is to allow couples to ritualize and to raise their voices up and to allow their community to affirm them in the way that our tradition teaches us.
Right.
And
right.
It's given me so much energy to encourage and to nurture other couples and just other human beings,
sure.
every soul, to find that goodness within them. It affects every part of the way that I work and
sure.
that I serve my community.
A few weeks ago, the dean of the National Cathedral here in D.C. got quite a bit of attention for challenging homophobia as a sin. Does that resonate for you and your tradition?
In my pulpit and in my community, I've had the privilege of counseling and working with a lot of people who come because I am an openly gay woman and clergy, and they struggle because they so badly want to walk in their world and in the light of God, and they want to feel that their tradition affirms them. And I sit with them and I say, you know, we have inherited a tradition to be a people literally that struggle with God. I mean, we mm-hmm. are, as in my faith tradition, as a Jewish woman, our name is Yisrael, which means to struggle with God. And mm-hmm. we have to continue to ask our tradition to evolve along the lines with us. I can't stand by and let one more young person extinguish their own life because they would, frankly, rather be dead than have to go against what they think their tradition is telling them right. is wrong about them.
Yeah.
And so I've made it really a very important part of my life, of my work, to lift a voice of affirmation and celebration of all kinds of people and of all kinds of couples. And I hope to just keep doing that.
As the nation continues to evolve on LGBT issues, what role do you see for people in public ministry? Is just the very notion of openness helpful, or is there a mandate for doing something more?
It would be very easy, since I live here in New Jersey, to, you know, celebrate our victory and just move on, you know, next cause. But I have to tell you that I'm pained that so few states in this incredible country where there is such freedom of choice here, that so few of our states are moving forward to integrate stronger legislation mm-hmm. for same-sex couples and for just LGBT people in general. So I think we have a really strong mandate. Look, there is a core teaching in my tradition to do litaken olam or tikkun olam, this idea that we have to do repair in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our mission as human beings, doing the right thing and living God's word. But what it tells us on the flip side of that is we can't begin to do that work out in the world until we can do it at home. Mm-hmm. We have to allow people to have that wholeness in their relationships at home with their significant other and with their children, with their families, with their parents. We have to allow that the home and the love that is between two people and between families to be nurtured and celebrated and affirmed. And I think we do that when we speak from the pulpit about inclusivity and diversity, and when we tell the truth about how our tradition teaches us that it's about love.
Mm.
I think it's a day at a time, and, you know, I'm ready to drive down to Pennsylvania and try to start doing the same work there that I was doing here in New Jersey and wherever else. It has to be by car, though. I can't leave my three little kids home with my wife all by themselves. I got to be able to get home at night. So, yeah, I think we need to do work. I want to celebrate, but I'm humbled, and we need to move forward.
Meredith Greenberg is the cantor at Temple Ner Tamid in Bloomfield, New Jersey. I think as she finished, I saw a whole bunch of you putting on your coats and running out the door to do something. I mean, she has moved us to
great.
Do something. As civil marriage equality was finally arriving in her state, she wed her longtime partner, Leora Perlman, on the Jersey City waterfront. Meredith, really, I thank you for sharing this time with us today here on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend, so much. Have a wonderful day.
Later in the show, the Reverend Richard Cizik, who's working to foster environmental awareness and concern over climate change in the evangelical community. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. it wasn't that long ago that the term libertarian evoked either perennial oddball presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche or a place to borrow books. Going by the new annual American Values Survey just released by the Public Religion Research Institute, all of that has changed. Today, over 20% of Americans can be categorized as libertarian or libertarian-leaning, placing these folks at the opposite end of the spectrum from communitarians, who number about the same. The new PRRI survey offers plenty of insights into the values and opinions that are shaping our democracy. And I'm very happy to welcome back our good friend, the Institute's founding CEO, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, glad you're here again.
Glad to be here.
Why the libertarians? Why focus on that?
We've seen a lot of renewed interest, really, in libertarians. We saw, Ron Paul really staking out some libertarian ground in the presidential election. We've seen Rand Paul more recently kind of stepping up. Closer to home here in D.C., we have a libertarian candidate running in Virginia in the governor's race that is currently pulling 11% of Republican support.
How did you define libertarian in this survey?
Well, you know, we didn't really know if there would be what we might call consistent libertarians in the country. And one of the reasons is that in our politics, the liberal to conservatives polls pull, I think, so heavily. And libertarians are this odd mix of people who tend to be fairly conservative on economic issues, but liberal on social issues. And that runs up against the kind of straight left to right spectrum. We went about defining them really around a set of 9 questions. So we built a scale out of 9 separate questions, and we gave them a score on each question. If they answered more on the libertarian end of the question, they would get a lower score. If they answered more on the communalist end of the spectrum, they get a higher score. And at the end of the day, we added them all up and then divided the scale into segments, and we sort of found that there were about 7% of Americans who were what we might call consistent libertarians. That is, across all 9 questions, basically gave consistent libertarian answers. There's an additional 15% that we might say like lean libertarian or sympathetic to libertarian answers. Most Americans are in the middle, 54% are mixed. And then we have a very symmetrical group of communalists on the other side, 7% who we might call consistent communalists, and an additional 17% that lean communalists.
Are self-defined libertarians politically active? Are they affiliated with political parties?
Yeah, they are fairly politically active. For example, a majority of them said that they always vote in primary elections, which is a very low turnout elections. But a majority, 53% of them, say that they always vote. That's about the same rate that Republicans overall say they always vote. It's a little lower than those who identify with the Tea Party, who are around 6 and 10, say that they always vote. But that's still a very active and engaged level of majority voting in primary elections.
That's the political breakout. What's the religious breakout?
Yeah. So the religious profile was pretty interesting for this group. We find that really a majority of them are accounted for by being religiously unaffiliated. 27% are religiously unaffiliated. And an identical group, 27%, are white mainline Protestants. So we see lower numbers of evangelicals in this group, lower numbers of Catholics in this group, absolutely no black Protestants in this group.
Why no black Protestants?
Well, I think if you look at the other end of the spectrum, it tells the story that on the other end of the spectrum, among the communalists, and that is, you know, the kind of thumbnail definition of that group is a group that favors high government intervention, even if at the cost of some personal liberties, right? So there's a group that's very comfortable with government involvement and regulation in society. That group is overrepresented by African-American Protestants and Catholics on the one hand. So communalists are made up of a majority, just those two groups, African-American Protestants and Catholics, make up a majority of communalists. And on the other end of the spectrum, among libertarians, the unaffiliated and white mainline Protestants. The other demographics that are probably helpful here, they're overwhelmingly white, so 94%, nearly all non-Hispanic white, nearly two-thirds are men, and more than 6 in 10 are under the age of 50. So it's really white, younger men that predominate in this libertarian category, and nearly 6 in 10 on the communalist end are women.
My goodness. So it's a dichotomy almost.
There really is. Yeah. There's big racial and gender divides running through this.
How much overlap did you find in the anti-government rhetoric of the Tea Party and the impulse toward minimizing government inherent in libertarianism as it's practiced today?
Yeah. Well, this is a great question, and I think really where the pay dirt of this survey was. So in 2010, we did a survey focused on the Tea Party, and there we found that about half of the Tea Party, 47%, also consider themselves part of the Christian right. I think you and I may have even talked about that
The
show.
Sure did.
What we found is that that continues to be true today of the Tea Party movement. About half, in fact, of slightly more, 52%, say they are also consider themselves part of the Christian right. But we didn't really know where libertarians fit into that that picture. What we know today really is that libertarians, most of them, as a matter of fact, 61% of them do not consider themselves part of the Tea Party movement. Right, they consider themselves outside of the Tea Party movement. Another way of thinking about that, if we look inside the Tea Party movement, only about a quarter of those who consider themselves part of the Tea Party movement are libertarians. Right, and so this really upends some of the real mythology, I think, that's been around the Tea Party movement, that they are primarily a libertarian influence, for example, on the Republican Party. In fact, what we see is that they, the Tea Party itself, is primarily a social conservative influence on the on the Republican Party. The libertarian movement is largely outside of the Tea Party movement, so actually something quite distinct.
It sure is. Yeah. When I look at the majority of libertarians that you report opposing marriage equality, it makes me wonder what the word has come to mean. If pandering to the religious right by restricting who can get married isn't the kind of government overreach you'd expect libertarians to oppose, I don't know what is. With the high percentage of religiously unaffiliated and mainline Protestants among libertarians today, how do you read that?
Yeah, this was one of the more puzzling findings of the survey, in fact. So just to pivot to abortion, where we did find what we would see among libertarians, so nearly 6 in 10 libertarians oppose making it more difficult for women to have an abortion in the country. That's what you would expect from a libertarian position. Mm-hmm. But when we looked at the issue of same-sex marriage, we see the opposite, right? We see a majority, in fact, almost the same number, 6 in 10, oppose to allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry. I think there's a couple of things going on there. First is, it's worth remembering that this group is overwhelmingly male. And what we know in the general population, and it's true in every age group, that men are much less supportive of same-sex marriage than women are. So that's certainly part of the story going on here. I think the other part of the story is that this issue has become so partisan in its divides that there is some kind of Republican affinity, gravitational pull at work here on this issue as well. That I think is eroding what would be a kind of straight up libertarian take on this particular issue.
One other issue is interesting to me. Looking at the report, I find it striking that the issue most galvanizing for libertarians seems to be health care expansion. More libertarians than Republicans, evangelicals, or even Tea Party members oppose it. What do you draw from that statistic?
Right. You know, the intensity of opposition to the Affordable Care Act is quite remarkable. 96% of libertarians have an unfavorable view of the 2010 health care law. So only 83% of white evangelicals do, 78% of Tea Party members do, 89% of Republicans do. But this is nearly all libertarians. Yeah. I mean, it really is a defining issue for the libertarian movement. We had a couple of different questions on healthcare. They basically all painted the same picture. And I think it comes down to the other question we had here was a question about whether the government should guarantee healthcare access or whether each person should on their own be responsible for getting healthcare access. 71% of libertarians said they very, very strongly agree that every person should be responsible for their own healthcare. And let the chips fall where they may. And so I think, you know, it's certainly right that this is a very defining, and the intensity on this issue really is stronger than we see on almost any other issue.
It'd be interesting to know, and I'm not assuming you do, but it would be interesting to know what that kind of galvanizing issue was before healthcare.
Right. Right, right. You know, I'm not sure I do know. I mean, I think that this has to do with, you know, that the contemporary context is about, you know, is within an Obama administration, and that this is a signature policy of the Obama administration. This group voted 80% for Romney, right? So this is a, even though they're libertarian and they only make up about 12% of the Republican Party, and if you ask them about party identification, less than half, actually 45%, identify as Republican, but when it comes to voting, 80% of them show up and vote and voted for Romney. Only 5% voted for Obama's, right? So this tells you and the other 14% voted for a third party candidate. You know, this 5% Obama, you know, thing is pretty consistent with 96% opposition to healthcare. So I think that's certainly part of what's going on here, is a kind of intense opposition to President Obama.
Are libertarians growing, or is it a fairly stable number?
You know, we don't know for sure, because this is the first time we've developed the scale for this survey, but we can look back at Gallup and Pew and some other there's been very, very little actually done on libertarians, but the last look that's comparable to what we did was done by Pew Research in 2011. They found 9% of the country to be libertarian, which is actually within the margin of error. So, you know, single digits, high single digit numbers seems to be a fairly consistent group. And just by the way, also, the Tea Party movement seems to be also fairly consistent. About 1 in 10 Americans identifying with the Tea Party ever since we started measuring this in 2010 up to the present. Every survey shows about 1 in 10.
Well, I got to ask you one other question about the Tea Party. Has that movement made itself known with direct involvement in electoral politics? Many see it as having redefine the way the Republican Party works today, but you've already addressed that. Other than favoring Ron Paul for president, do you see Americans who identify as libertarian as a organized force in government?
Right. You know, I would say this is something that does separate the libertarian constituency, and I would choose that word, a constituency, more than a Tea Party movement, and I would probably use that word with the Tea Party, is that they are fairly dispersed geographically. They're not all that organized. You know, there's the official Libertarian Party, but only about 15% of libertarians identify with the Libertarian Party. So that's not the organizing vehicle for the movement. And I think what remains to be seen is if in specific elections, like the Virginia governor's race, right? Mm-hmm. So if it turns out to be right now, it looks like Cuccinelli is significantly behind McAuliffe. But if it turns out to be getting close, and you've got a third party libertarian candidate who's pulling 9 points from Republicans and only 2 points from Democrats, it's going to hurt Republican candidates a lot more in some specific elections. And it could really swing the outcome of the elections in some specific cases.
Robbie, I can't quit without asking the one question I always ask, and that what surprised you most about in this survey?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we didn't know what with any confidence what the religious makeup was, I think, of this group and how the religious groups play here. So I think, you know, the high composition of the nuns or the religiously unaffiliated in the libertarian movement. And then I think the other thing that was really striking is the really strong gender divides here with, you know, 2/3 men among libertarians and 6 in 10 women among communalists, you know, on the opposite ends of the spectrum. So clearly some real gender disagreements about, you know, the role of government, the responsibility of individuals. Men and women seem to see this very differently in the country.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, always a source for invaluable insights into the viewpoints and values of our diverse society. The 2013 American Values Survey has just been released, and you can delve into its many fascinating findings online at publicreligion.org. Robbie, as always, thanks for being with us on State of Belief today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. The Reverend Richard Cizik is president of the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good. He's calling on the board of the National Association of Evangelicals to take a leadership position on the issue of climate change, and he's urging that environmental concerns be a priority for the new evangelical movement. Rich, welcome to State of Belief Radio again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Walt.
I have a hunch we ought to start with a quick definition in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with the concept of new evangelicals.
Well, here's how we define it, and we call ourselves new evangelicals because we are evangelicals, but we believe that we need a new public engagement by evangelicals in this country that, one, is about love, not hate, that's about unity, not division, that is about a broad agenda of issues, including the environment, poverty, and human rights, and the like, and not simply the litmus test issues of the religious right. And then lastly, new evangelicals are people who don't sublimate their Christian faith to a political ideology.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to sublimate that is to make our faith secondary to a political ideology, whether it's the right or left, mm-hmm. is really a heresy.
Mm-hmm.
C.S. Lewis called it the devil's lie, namely to make politics more than it ought to be. And we certainly have a kind of politics in America that's merged with religion nowadays in which a lot of people are unwilling to compromise about anything
mm-hmm.
because, in my estimation, they've made ideology a god. And I think new evangelicals are appreciative of the need for compromise. We are people who believe in finding common ground. Thus, the name of the organization that we've adopted is New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, because we as Americans have lost that concept that we have to work for the common good.
You know, I think I heard applause. Rich, you've posted a petition on groundswellmovement.org aimed at the National Association of Evangelicals. What's the objective of the petition, which has already received several thousand signatures?
The objective, Walton, is simply to ask the evangelical leadership of the association, which in the interest of disclosure, I should say, I worked for the association for 28 years, left in 2008 for a variety of reasons, including my stance on climate change, civil unions, Barack Obama, and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've waited these 5 years in hopes that the association would finally acknowledge publicly the reality of climate change occurring as it is around the globe, and our moral responsibility as evangelical Christians to address these issues, especially issues that impact the poor,
mm-hmm.
most of all. And I've waited in hopes that the organization would do this, but it hasn't. That despite the fact that in Cape Town, South Africa, 3 years ago, all the evangelicals who meet at the Lausanne meeting adopted a statement similar to what I'm asking for the association to do here in the United States, simply that these developments, namely climate change, is real. We're doing this. It's anthropogenic in nature mostly, and that we have a moral responsibility out of our concern for neighbor. In other words, Jesus' own admonition, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, to do this. But I have waited, and with no ill will intended whatsoever, and with goodwill, because I consider these my friends and colleagues, I'm simply saying that the evangelical leadership of America, of the NAE, the National Association of Evangelicals, still considers itself a leader. It should take this step. And it's not too much to ask. We're not even asking for the organization to adopt some kind of politics on this, for that matter. We're simply saying this is a biblical thing. And yet, we wait. And so sometimes, as you know, Welton, you engage in private diplomacy. We do that with governments all the time. We do it as people with our friends. We engage them privately. And then at times it's important to engage in public diplomacy. And this is a form of public diplomacy, simply holding the church leadership responsible.
Now, Rich, you have the audacity to think that climate change and the environment are moral issues. Jesus didn't have anything to do with that. I've been told that.
Well, Jesus, we were told during the civil rights movement, didn't have anything to say about civil rights either. Or we were told by people in the conservative religious movement back in the 1950s and 60s that, well, the Bible sanctioned segregation or the like. And it, of course, did none of the sort. But what I'm saying today, to make a comparison that I hope people won't be offended by, I was, as the slave ship commander John Newton said, I once was blind, but now I see.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversion on the science of climate change, and I don't think it's hyperbole to quote John Newton on the subject, given the appalling and disgusting degradation to which he stooped. That was racism, slave ship racism, and from which he was rescued. And so for those who have the eyes to see, they must recognize that the enslavement of racism finds parallels in the unjust raping of the earth that plunged millions upon millions into powerless poverty in today's world as environmental refugees, and that's already occurring. And so I happen to think, in contrast to my critics and those who don't see it this way, that yes, the climate change is the civil rights issue of the 21st century.
Mm. The fact is that evangelical Christians influence scores of people in this nation, and if that very valued community would pick up on the crucial moral issue of environment and climate change, could make all the difference in the world. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And when you consider the fact that Republicans are heavily influenced themselves by evangelicals, because evangelicals constitute 40 to 50% of the Republican Party in America today, if the evangelicals were to speak out on this issue, you might not have the 160 members of the House of Representatives, 160 Republicans of the House of Representatives, who don't believe in the reality of climate change. And
right.
So I think that the importance of the organization to speak out is self-evident. In fact, you could say, Walton, that it's a sign of our respect for the association that we ask it to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what is really occurring, to quote my friend Larry Schweiger, who's the head of the National Wildlife Federation, in his book Last Chance, what is occurring is a matter of political expediency over ethical leadership, and Larry calls it willful blindness.
Yeah.
Willful blindness.
Rich, on your website, there's a video critical of the Obama administration on their stewardship of public lands that could be considered as coming from the left. It suggests that the president has been too accommodating on business interests. Is that first an accurate interpretation? And then are there other issues that you see being handled that same way? Because if that's true, that shatters the simplistic Christian right Obama left narrative that's led to a paralysis on so many issues.
Well, it is accurate, exactly what we're saying. Namely, that the equal ground we're calling for, that is for the Obama administration to equalize the amount of public lands it's granted already, about 6.9 million acres to oil and gas leases, to equalize that amount to that for wilderness, national parks, monuments, and the rest. So there's been a real disparity between the two. And so, yes, the Obama administration, which is constantly being attacked by Republicans for its so-called leftist policies, on this case, is very pro-business, has been very pro-oil and gas leases, and this isn't right either.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're simply calling to task the Obama administration and asking it to more boldly defend what it ought to be defending. In fact, it's not just the Obama administration on this one, it's the Republican House of Representatives, in which for the very first time since World War II, a Congress has not taken the action it has customarily done to preserve national park, a national park monuments, or the rest. And so this last Congress was the first time that didn't happen. And so this is public land.
Mm-hmm.
As Woody Guthrie sang so many years ago, this is my land, this is your land, it belongs to us, and we think the administration should acknowledge this. So we're not simply as a new evangelicals, we're not going to give the president a pass on something that's not right either. We're simply balanced, and we think we're right. I think in their hearts, they know that we're right, too.
Well, and I also think it's an excellent model of someone who understands that we can't let the politics of the nation define the moral priorities of the nation, and you're clearly showing that.
We're trying to be fair, and that's what I think so many people in this country already believe. I don't think we're all that unusual. Most Americans simply want us to find solutions, solve problems, govern the country like we're and they're elected to do, and we're responsible as citizens to help make happen. And so we need to get on with this, and enough of this business of shutting down the government, enough of this business of catering to special interests. Let's serve the common good. We know that the problem here isn't not having enough science. The problem isn't not having the resources to do these things. It frankly usually comes down to political will.
Right.
Will we have the political will to solve problems?
I have to tell you, I've been sitting here during this interview smiling the whole time because I know your passion, and I hear it, and I appreciate it. And actually, I'll just be very honest and say I was thinking about when Jesus said that a prophet's not without honor in his own country. Actually, you defy that. You are without honor in lots of circles of the evangelical community.
Now, yeah, I take my hits as you take yours.
But that leads to the question I wanted to ask you.
Yep.
You have really given up some very important parts of your life and sometimes in fellowship in order to do what you're doing. What is it that every morning gets you up with hope that some of the current polarization in our culture, and we have to be honest, a lot of it involves conservative religion being misused to manipulate politics. What is it that gets you up saying that can be overcome?
Well, I think it's rooted in a biblical Christian faith, but even beyond that, for those who don't share my evangelical faith, I simply subscribe to the 19th century presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, who wasn't evangelical, by the way, his admonition that destiny is not a matter of chance, but of choice, and not something to wish for, but to attain. And so I say to myself, as I say to others every day, my destiny, our destiny, is really ours to choose. And God help us if we don't.
Mm.
And I also say, social change begins with me.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, my first reaction isn't, if only the big corporations, Wall Street, government, the Tea Party would change or whatever. Most of the time, I just begin with the assumption each morning, dear Lord, help me to change to be the kind of person you want me to be.
Hmm.
And that gives me hope because I have changed.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know that.
Yeah.
And I happen to think a lot of people have to change with me on these issues, and I see them having those kinds of conversions all the time.
I'm in full
agreement.
And
that kind of change is what gives me great, great hope, because I know it can happen. Because if someone like me, who had been a part of the warp and woof of the religious right for so many years, as head of the Washington office for the National Association of Evangelicals, if I can change, mercy, anybody can change.
Yeah, I have the same feeling as a former leader in the Southern Baptist Convention. The Reverend Richard Cizik is president of the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good. You can find his petition to the board of the National Association of Evangelicals regarding global climate change at www.groundswell-movement.org. Rich, I always enjoy being with you, and we don't get to do that enough, but I really am grateful to you for being a part of State of Belief Radio today and enlightening but also inspiring us.
Well, God bless you, my friend. I count it a privilege to be able to call you that.
Now, before we go, I want to ask you to do something. I don't do that very often, but I have it on my conscience today and want to do it. There was a time I thought any legislative proposal to strengthen civil rights and assure freedom with equity would pass easily in our Congress. Not so, though. And ironically, a lack of commitment to religious freedom has been a part of the problem here. So it has been a part of the problem with passing the legislation known as ENDA, Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Ever since I came to D.C. 16 years ago, some form of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act has been before Congress. Early on, it got nowhere quickly and a lot of criticism. Plenty of people have claimed that their religious freedom, which allows them to label homosexuality as a sin, also allows them to discriminate against gays and lesbians in the workplace by denying them the same right other people have in the workplace. Well, that is not fair, and it certainly isn't right in the opinions of many of us. Well, next week, we will likely have a chance to make a significant step toward ENDA becoming a law. Majority Leader in the U.S. Senate, Harry Reid, has promised a vote on ENDA likely this coming week. We're counting 58 votes for the bill in the United States Senate. That's too short of the 60 that we would need to protect it from a filibuster. Just this past week, Senators Bill Nelson and Mark Pryor have said they will vote for the bill. An approval of this bill, friends, becoming law in the Senate, would be a terrific step forward. As always, I want to be honest with you about this. Even if the Senate passes this important legislation and gives it to the House, well, the House isn't going to do a thing about it. Remember, we're still dealing with politics, not miracles here. But also, one can take a giant step forward if we combat discrimination by the passage of this bill in the Senate. I say all of that to ask you to please call the Capitol switchboard and ask to speak to your senators so you can encourage them to vote for this bill. Here's the number, 202-224-3132, the Capitol switchboard. Call your congressman that way, senator especially, and you can make a contribution to what could be a historic moment. You also could go to our website, the Interfaith Alliance website, interfaithalliance.org. Take action, help change history, and advance freedom. Seriously, it's that important. Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week. Use Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen as well. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.